from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And this is the Summer of Food on Connections. Our connection this hour was made the last time you went out to eat. It's the Summer of Food, and we're taking up the subject that has been debated often in kitchens and glossy food magazines, maybe in cocktail bars or wine bars. Is food and drink, can it be art? Or perhaps, should food be art? Is it just fuel? Maybe there's someone in your life who's so skilled that you can't help but look at their cooking or their cocktails as artistic in some way. Maybe there's someone who puts a menu together and you think, you're not just putting a menu together, you're an artist. Maybe there's a restaurant where you feel hesitant to eat the food because it looks breathtaking on the plate. Or maybe you think food is really just fuel, and we should just stuff it with all this talk about food as art. Well, Chef Dominique Ancel once said, quote, "If anything, food is a more intimate form of art compared to others, as it incorporates all of the senses," end quote. Chef Jose Andres says, quote, "Of course food is art. To me, art should be a thrill for all of the senses," end quote. This hour, tell us where you fall in the debate over food and drink as art, and who in your life, maybe it's your mother or your grandmother, or maybe it's a restaurant that you love to go to. Maybe there is a sommelier or a cocktail maker or a chef who's just doing it so well that you think that's art. And probably, if you had to press me, one of the people in that category would be Sean Wolf, executive chef at Farmers Creekside Tavern and Inn out in Leroy on the Owatka Creek. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Evan. Nice to see you.
Well, it's great to see you. And Drew Chappett is here, sommelier out at Farmers. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Always a pleasure.
Also with us is Lorna Underwood, owner and general manager of Caribbean Heritage Restaurant. Lorna, welcome. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And it's great to have you. And Kimberly Roth is the owner of and chef at Bamboo Panda Catering. She was a Hell's Kitchen finalist a couple of years ago. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm just going to ask all of you just for one brief thought out of the gate, whether food is art. Is it art?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yes.
All the time, or it can be art under certain circumstances?
I believe under certain circumstances.
All right, that's
yeah.
fair. Okay. Yeah. And so when you are creating, are you trying to do something that is artistic?
Yes, because people eat with their eyes. People don't want to eat a pile of dog food, you know? So it's the chef that actually has to take advantage of the plating and the product and the sourcing and everything else, you know, and make it visibly pleasing because, you know, that's if I see something that looks bad, I'm going to be like hesitant to eat it. If I see something that's appealing and that's making me drool already without even, you know, tasting it, yeah, I'm going for it.
All right. Lorna, food as art, yes or no?
It can be, because truly, most often when you eat something, it looks good. It has to look good. But some things taste good without looking good. So I'd say sometimes it can be.
Okay. Sean Wolf.
I absolutely think that food can be art. That's how we approach it. The thing that Chef Ancel said about all five senses, that's very important. You know, we eat with our eyes first, but also, you know, if the steak is sizzling on the plate, we're hearing that, and that may start our salivation. Taste, they say, is 90% smell. So it's really engaging all of the senses.
Do we overdo the visual side of it?
I think that we place a lot more emphasis than there really is on it. I mean, certainly it has to look pretty, and we spend a lot of time on that. But I think that the other senses being engaged are just as important.
Drew, having written about wine for a number of years, the question of whether wine is art comes up quite a lot here. And it's always fascinating because there's some winemakers who will tell you, yes, absolutely. And then there's some who will go, that is so pretentious. You know, and I'm curious to know as a sommelier where you see on the drink side of things, if you see art as a component there.
That is a tough question, and I think, like food, it depends on a very specific set of circumstances. And I think we have to take a look at how we define art, first of all, before we can kind of get into the nitty-gritty of that.
I think that's very fair. So go ahead, take a stab at it. How are you defining it in this context, then?
So this is actually a conversation Sean and I have had on numerous occasions, and it's sort of an ongoing conversation. And it's kind of too big a question just to pigeonhole it into one generic definition. That being said, how I personally look at it is sort of the intentional transmission or expression of culture or imagination, or sort of the way we experience the world, in a form that evokes either emotional response or challenges our perceptions of the world.
Okay. Sean, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'm kind of the opinion that of the Duchamp camp, where art is whatever the artist says it is. You know, I mean, he went to an exhibition and hung a urinal on a wall and said, "Behold."
Come on, man.
Yeah, well, you go to MoMA and there's painted 2x4s on the wall or strings held together.
Okay, see, but we're going to fight over this. We're going to fight, Sean Wolf. Here's why. I am somebody, I'm going to out myself. When I go to, I was in Bilbao in Spain with the WXXI Travel Club and the Guggenheim. There was a canvas on the floor, huge canvas, and the artist had hung... had been sort of hanging over off a platform, dumping blue paint from about 40 meters down onto the canvas. And that was it. Just blue paint from 40 meters. That was the art. And the artist's explanation was, well, I don't think the artist should directly engage with the canvas. And I said, interesting. Next time I host a show, I'm going to say the intro. And then I'm going to say, guests, talk amongst yourself, because I don't think the host ought to directly talk to anybody they're interviewing. So I'll see you in an hour. Have a great time. I didn't get it. Even though they said most of the stuff in the Guggenheim was art, I didn't get it. I didn't see it as art.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of take the counterpoint on this.
See, I like it. We're fighting already. This is good.
So Sean brought up the Duchamp hanging a urinal on the wall, and he says it's art. But can something be art if the consumers don't view it that way? For instance, if I walked into that building and I saw a urinal hanging on the wall, if I didn't know it was intentional, would I just think, hey, these guys have no idea how to install a bathroom?
But I think it's perspective as well. I think it's everybody has a different perspective on what art is. So I think that's what you're saying. You're saying this is not art.
Well, I think it's more just I maybe don't want to go as far to say as what I saw at the Guggenheim wasn't art. It's that I didn't find any connection to it.
Okay.
And I thought that the creation was so vague as to be uninspiring. Mm-hmm. That's where I was. Whereas I'd have no problem finding connection to the food that you make. I'm not pandering. I mean, I say that honestly. Mm-hmm. If you want to tell me that there's something artistic about this creation, I can't argue with it. Because there's so many elements of intentionality that you're creating, not just, as Sean points out, and the chefs I quoted pointed out, all the different senses that we're working on. Mm-hmm. I actually think that's much more artistic than what I saw in the Guggenheim. If I went to Caribbean Heritage or any of... But do you think that's wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Okay, well, but Sean, push back now. Let's fight a little, because if you were at the Guggenheim with me and I went, I don't get that, man. Come on.
Well, that didn't speak to you.
Right.
And just like the things that we do.
I don't think it spoke to the artist. That's what I'm saying. I think the artist was just like, let's just dump paint from 40 meters
let's
and then
try this
cash
and
a check, man.
And he's in the Guggenheim.
So I know.
Somebody on a board of directors or whatever said, yes, this speaks to me.
Yes.
Somebody is writing an email to me right now saying, Evan, you have so disappointed me today. I've listened for years, and I didn't know you were such a Philistine. And it turns out, I am. But listeners, please try to sway me on the modern art stuff, because I'm trying. I'm trying. Oh, I don't know. Where are you on that, Kimberly?
I mean, honestly, just listening to you guys, I think art is a progression of life. I think it started off in a certain way with the ancient statues of Greece, and I'm relating this to food. Food used to be simple and elegant, but now throughout time, it's evolved to be, you know, tweely and colorful and this and that, much like art. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not really into art. I just like making food look pretty so people pay me. I mean, much like that artist probably just wanted to cause a stir. Maybe he knew it was, you know, not going to be considered art. Maybe he wanted to make you think like that. Maybe he's trying to stir up controversy. I don't know.
Well, and to be fair here.
Make you think about it.
And to be fair, what makes me think is not going to be the same as what makes Lorna or Sean or Drew or anybody think. Yeah. And I take that point, which is why I do, as much as I've been a little cheeky about the Guggenheim, There was one piece there that was all a big black canvas, and with tiny little blip of light, maybe 1/1000th of the canvas in the bottom corner. And the name of the piece was something like One Voice. And it was about the notion of political darkness and how sometimes one voice from the proletariat can actually spark change and light, but it has to come from the ground up. And I thought, okay, that speaks to me. Whereas
Absolutely.
A lot of people walk by Absolutely. It and went, I got nothing. I got mm-hmm. nothing. That mm-hmm. one was like, yes, I'm there. Whereas sometimes just a dot, I don't get. Tom writes to us and says, Evan, art, this is a quote from Marshall McLuhan, art is anything you can get away with. Well, that's a little cynical, like a urinal on a wall. Go ahead, Sean.
I think that buys into the same, art is whatever the artist says it is. And, I mean, I think sometimes art is intentionally provocative. I mean, you talk about a guy dumping paint from 45
yeah.
meters above. I mean, we're here talking about it however many years after he made it.
That's good.
You should dump your next burger That's from good. 40
Gravy.
Meters and see how that goes, man.
That's already in the works.
Thank you, Drew. If you're just joining us on the Summer of Food, we've already taken more turns than I expected this hour, which is why we invited these guests for this awesome conversation about food as art. In a moment, I'm just going to ask them to kind of tell you a little bit about where you'll find them and what they do, because some of the names you know, some of the names that you'll hear on the Summer of Food will be new to you, and we're really enjoying it. And if you want to weigh in on your thoughts as food and drink as art, you can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. We'll get Heather and Ithaca in just a second. Sue emails the program to say, I decorate my home every season with food. My island is my palette and food is my paint. Fruit, vegetables, and herbs are the most beautiful things in our world. And you just cannot be sad when you see them together as art. That's good stuff. I like that. I mm-hmm. like that a lot because mm-hmm. what that says is we're going to consume these, but throughout the season, we're going to place them in public to the home, public places where you can walk by and experience them and not just keep them covered up or in a refrigerator or in a cupboard. I like that a lot, Sue. I find that very, very swaying to me. Heather and Ithaca on the line next. Go ahead, Heather.
Hi. I used to teach expressive arts and recreation at TC3, and the book that I work from, the definition of art to them is something for the artist is done either to elicit a reaction or to create beauty in their eyes. And, you know, we used to talk about that a lot with students, and I used to show them there are two great episodes, one from Murphy Brown and one from Designing Women, where they look at the pop art like, is this art? You know, they think they've just dropped a bunch of sweet and low packets on the floor, but it's a innovation, you know? So it really is, beauty and art are both in the eye of the beholder, and I think if it needs to be explained, I'm not sure if that's art, but I definitely think that we have moved into the realm where food can be very artful and beautiful and not just for the nose and the taste buds, but an explosion of expression for the eye as well.
I love that. Heather, that is great stuff. And I'm gonna sort of pivot off that with a question for our guests about scale. Because I think Heather makes some great points there. I'm going to start on the drink side and then want to go to the food side. I think in the Finger Lakes region, just about everything from Herman Wehmer or Red Tail Ridge, most wineries, I actually think what they're creating is very artistic. I really do. Whereas something like Red Cat is consistent. Anheuser-Busch makes products that are consistent. Craft brewers make products that are more artistic. And I know that may sound sort of pretentious or high-minded or whatever, but I think it has to do with scale. If you like Red Cat, and that is totally cool if you do, what you want is the same thing every time, consistency. You don't want change. You don't care about the vintage it was. In fact, it's a non-vintage beverage. So the year or the weather, that doesn't matter. Whereas if you're picking up a 2016 Riesling from the Finger Lakes versus a 2017, 2016 was, you know, ridiculous in terms of as cruise control vintage as you can get in a region where weather is tough. And 2017 mm-hmm. is harder than what my calculus tests used to be for me. I mean, that was a nightmare. And yet, they're very different products, but they're both awesome. I find a lot of art in that. I think it's the scale issue. Is there an argument to be made there?
Yeah. I guess I'll
You're going to go with that?
So talking about scale, and I think to your point, something that's lower production, maybe 200, 500 cases, like you might get at Herman Wehmer versus, you know, Kendall Jackson Chardonnay, which is
everywhere, ubiquitous,
hundreds and hundreds and thousands of cases. So our natural tendency as sommeliers is to sort of gravitate towards the small artisanal, quote unquote, producers. I try not to think that way, because I've been humbled enough by wine to realize that I need to take each wine on an individual case. So who's to say that because Kendall Jackson is mass produced that the wine can't be an art form? Because it's actually very, very difficult to make wine, almost even more so when you're making something as conventional as that, because, you know, and I'm getting into sort of tricky waters here with the whole natural versus conventional wine. But, you know, to make a conventional wine, it can be a lot harder at times just because you're crafting something. And if you're sort of in more of the natural camp, you're letting it happen to an extent. So to sort of circle back here, I would disagree with you.
Oh, that's
from that perspective.
No, that's actually a very interesting point, because if wine were an actual canvas, a natural wine would have a lot less paint on the canvas, whereas the conventional wine, so to speak, would have a lot more of the artist's hand on it.
Right, and that's not always the intent, because obviously you can douse stains with chemicals and put them through machines, and that helps you along the way. But you know, it's just generically very hard to make wine either naturally or conventionally. So I just try to take each wine individually, and I wouldn't necessarily place a moniker of something like Herman Wehmer being art, or not art for that matter, versus something like a Kendall Jackson.
Or a Red Cat, So, and which isn't not, by the way, to denigrate at all. It was just an observation. But I think Drew, who is emerging as a really smart, interesting contrarian, he's probably the person who loves to take the counterpoint in every argument. So now on the food side, I'd love all of our guests to kind of weigh in on whether, if you had to make one, and you know, pick whatever it is that, that you make and that you make well, that's sort of your meat and potatoes, you know, a very commonly produced food item. If you had to make one versus 100, could you do the one more artistically, or am I off with the scale idea? I'll start with you, Sean.
I think that most of what we do is recreatable and repeatable. So, I mean, I guess within reason, if I had to make 1 million of something, how could I do that? But if I had to make 100 or 200, we're doing a dinner coming up at the Smith Opera House for 200 people. I think that every dish is going to be artistic and very close to being the same.
Okay, fair enough. See, look, I love being disabused in the. I love being wrong. Lorna?
Definitely. I think if you're cooking for 1 million people, you'll definitely get a variation. But if you're cooking for, if you're used to cooking for 200, 100, then your spices, you know what they're supposed to taste like up here. So you'll get it right all the way through. And coming from Jamaica, in terms of eating with your eyes and color and so on, you go to the market, everything is colorful. So I think using all those spices to get that food right is always right here. It's here in your mind.
She's pointing to the heart and then to the mind.
In my mind, yes. So when you go to make it, you have it down. I believe in consistency.
That's a great point. So if you're cooking for the Pope or the full congregation, you can repeat it.
Yes.
Okay. Kimberly.
I mean, if you can make it once, you can make it 1,000 times. I mean, I guess even with what I do, I specialize in Asian fusion and sushi. So being individual sushi rolls, you know, I do put my heart and soul, and there's a lot of elements that go into one specific roll. But if I can't replicate that and make 1,000 people happy, then I shouldn't be making just one. You know, I guess to me, it's kind of saying it's opposite of like that one painting, I guess. So this is where I'll disagree with the food is art kind of thing, because that one painting is all you need. But for me, I don't know, just one would not be enough. You know, I guess I've made sushi in this town for 16 years, you know, and I evolve. But, you know, if I can't repeat what I've done once, then it's It's pointless.
Is there someone in your life, Kimberly, when you were growing up, who created food, a dish? Is there a single dish or a single person who you went, to me, that was special, that was beyond just food as fuel, that was food as art?
Yeah, more than one, actually. That's what actually drove me to be a chef. You know, my great-grandma came from Italy. So, I mean, having that in my life and just, you know, remembering her meatballs every Sunday that were spot-on perfect for 20 years, you know. My grandma, my dad, was a huge contributor to me and my love of food and being a chef. My dad's steak au poivre is my favorite. And I made it for Gordon Ramsay, too. And he loved it, you know. So, it's... You know, that's one thing that does stick out to me. You know, there's also things that stick out to me that were absolutely awful, you know, but you try to remember the best.
Well, that's an interesting parallel to art, because what you remember is the stuff that's great or horrible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You rarely remember the mediocre. Yeah. You rarely remember the mediocre. Bamboo Panda Catering has been existed for how long?
Coming up on 5 years.
5 years.
5 years.
How did you end up on Hell's Kitchen?
I'm crazy. I just literally, throughout my career, I've always been doubted just because I come off a little bit ditzy and because I'm a woman. And everyone always just said that I wasn't ever capable or able to do that. And I was like, you know, watch me, watch me. I had so many naysayers and I kept applying to the show and applying and applying. And one day we had a professional photographer hanging out on my food truck, took a really great picture. And then I submitted it, and they called me within an hour. They're like, hey, you know, come to New York City, try out. So I did. And then they called me back a month later, sent me to L.A., sent me home, sent me to L.A., sent me home. And then 6 days before we would start filming, they say, hey, you know, tie up your loose ends. We want you. And then I go
there. 6 days?
Yeah, 6 days to tie up my entire life with a fifth time on almost five-year-old, a home and a business. And then I went and cried and... Yeah, it was the best and worst time of my life. But
why the worst?
They seclude you. You have no phone, no windows, no radio, no contact to the outside world. I spent Thanksgiving crying in a hotel room by myself on Thanksgiving and a crappy piece of cheesecake and missing my family. And I'm being berated and yelled at and screamed at in front of, you know, 44 countries, tens of millions of people, and one of the best chefs in the world. Like, it's very intimidating. I went to nursing school. I dropped out 3 times, and I was finally said, I'm going to be a chef. I'm done. And to go with minimal experience except the 350 cookbooks that I have and what I learned as a child through my family to go up against Ramsay was kind of like, oh, my God. But I did it. You know, and I actually still work for him at the Atlantic City Gordon Ramsay Pub and Grill. They bring me out there doing guest chef dinners in his restaurant a few times a year. So it's still kind of fun to do that and working with the head chef and stuff like that, Christina Wilson. And, you know, still doing stuff back home, too. But, you know, my daughter and I, we travel a lot throughout the country doing a lot of charity events. Not for the Ramsay group, but just independently through the Hell's Kitchen. You know, a bunch of us chefs get together and travel the country and do charity dinners and stuff like that. But it was a cool experience. It was awesome. My daughter got to go. They surprised me with her, which was awesome because I hadn't seen her for, you know, a month and a half. So that was kind of cool.
And they probably wouldn't have success for shows like Hell's Kitchen, Top Chef. My son the other day told me he was styling his hair like Che from Top Chef Junior. Or Master Chef Junior.
He's cutie.
He is cutie.
We watched that. Yep. We watched that too.
And I don't think those shows would work if food didn't have an artistic quality.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I don't know, but I think, like what Lorna said, I love curries. I love curry. Go curry. I love it. And it's not always pretty to look at. Brown sauce, brown meat, the white rice. It's kind of no contrast. Delicious, though. Absolutely delicious.
You should come by.
Her and I are already talking. I'm like, we're going to go check her food out. It smells really good already. But I don't know. I guess to some extent, I think food in general just makes you happy. You know, food brings people together at the table. It's what families celebrate with, you know, and it's that one main thing is food that brings people together. So whether it's considered art, considered not, I mean, it is the eye of the beholder, like we said. You know?
And where will people find Bamboo Panda Catering now?
I am actually a private chef through my DBA is the Bamboo Panda Catering Company. I'm looking for a spot to rent right now. You can contact me on Instagram at chef_Kim_1101 or through Facebook. I also do freelance part-time at California Roland in the Port of Rochester down in Charlotte. I'm a chef there part-time. I worked there for a lot of years and recently went back over the summer to help out. You know, contact me. I do dinners, weddings, private dinners of two. I'm not just sushi. You know, people have had me do the whole Hell's Kitchen menu with the risottos and this and that. You know, it's scallops. You know, scallops are a big thing. Wellington, stuff like that, too. So, I mean, just look me up. Kimberly Roth.
Lorna Underwood, you grew up where? With that accent, I'm saying.
Jamaica.
Penfield? Oh, Jamaica.
Came here when I was 13. So I've lived here most of my life.
Was there a person who, or a single dish or a single person that you think back to your own upbringing that food was art?
No, but I believe I came from a large family. And food, we always cooked. From the time you were like 10, we didn't have chips and dips and for snacks. So we went in the yard to get the food and you cook it. You eat the okras raw or you eat your mangoes and everything. So just coming from that and having to prepare, by the time you were 14, you're preparing a meal for home, you know, for the whole family. And being able to do that, you start to, I'm from a family of six children. I'm the only one who became the foodie. Hmm. Not everybody else liked to cook and, you know, be in the kitchen all the time. But when before my dad passed, we decided that we were going to celebrate him with family gatherings. And in doing that, my siblings and I went every Sunday from one house to the other, bringing our foods together. So even though I've cooked for years, in those moments, it gave me the opportunity to start, you know, experimenting with different things. And now the restaurant I have, it's more of a fusion between Caribbean and American, because I use zucchini butternut, which is the squash dish that I brought some to you. You can check it out. And, you know, lentils and so on. So I started fusing things together, and my family loved it. My husband, my children, they loved it. So then everything started to fusing, but I never left the Caribbean side. So I kind of, infused everything together. We still have jerk chicken, very authentic. We still have curry goat, very authentic. So my mother, my aunts, my siblings, I learned from them, which makes really good. My sisters, everybody cooked, but I'm the one with the cooking blessing.
And where will people find Caribbean Heritage Restaurant?
719 South Plymouth Avenue at the corner of South Plymouth and Columbia.
What should they order?
They should order curry cod. That is one of my dishes that I came up with.
Curry cod.
Curry cod, and it's been a great hit. And we're still doing it authentic and tasty.
And what do you sell the most of?
Jerk chicken and oxtails.
Very good.
Yes.
Caribbean Heritage Restaurant. After our only break of the hour, Sean and Drew are going to tell you about the work they're doing at Farmers Creekside out in Leroy. It's a conversation during this summer of food, as food as art. And that's what we're kind of debating. Food, drink, the artistic aspects of it, and some of the really talented people who are doing it that way here in our region. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we continue on the Summer of Food next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Boris Johnson is the new Prime Minister of the UK. We talked to Brits here in Rochester about their experience with then-Mayor Boris Johnson of London and their thoughts on him as the future leader. He says he is going to bring prosperity to the UK. Our guests weigh in on Boris Johnson on Friday. Welcome back to Connections in the Summer of Food. Sean Wolf is the executive chef at Farmers Creekside Tavern and Inn out in Leroy. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rochester.
Grew up in Rochester.
Yep.
Was there a person, was there a dish that was food as art for you growing up?
For me, it was art as art. I mean, food was food because we had to eat food, but I had a real interest in art. And then I got a job in high school because I needed to make money, and I was a dishwasher, and then I became upgraded to a cook. And then I went to art school, which really qualified me to continue whatever I was doing before I went to art school, which was cooking. And it took many, many years for me to kind of make the connection that what I was doing was actually feeding this need to create art. I have no discernible fine art talent. I can't play any musical instrument. I can't draw. I can't paint. I can't even take a good photograph. So I've always been a huge disappointment to myself who's had this,
to yourself.
This need to create art with no ability to do so. But probably at about 40 years old, I really made this connection that, wow, I mean, this is, you know, we talked about touching all of the senses and kind of creating things, just picking two maybe disparate things and putting them together in a way that is maybe counterintuitive. And coming up with something that's really awesome, maybe provocative, you know, certainly subjective. Many people take exception to some of the things that we do, and that's okay.
That is a really interesting and circuitous story. Did you think when you were 25 years old, what did you think you were going to be doing with your life?
I thought that I was going to be an engineer, likely. Mm-hmm. And I did go back to study engineering and computers and was doing some freelance work when I kind of had the epiphany, like, wait a minute, why am I running away from food when this is the thing that really fuels my soul?
And if you didn't grow up, you know, sort of on the hip of someone who was doing it at a super high level, how did you become the chef that you are today?
I think kind of the science background helps because it's caused me to question everything and then record my results. So we do a lot of things. We ask why. I mean, this is a big thing that Drew and I talk about all the time. We always ask why. Why do we do it this way? Why do we boil pasta in a large volume of hot water? What if we used a small volume? What happens? So we ask these questions, and sometimes we find answers. Sometimes we don't.
Hmm. With your science background, what do you make of molecular gastronomy?
So that's really the thing that got me. When Alinea came out with their cookbook in 2008, I really was like, whoa, like, what is this? This is really different than anything that I thought food could be. And it really got me thinking, like, yeah, there's a whole world out there to be explored rather than just throwing a steak on the grill or, you know, a curried goat. Mm-hmm. There's things that haven't even been imagined. And there's some things that maybe it's a stretch to call food sometimes.
Truly.
It's interesting. Do you like molecular gastronomy?
Yeah, the term itself, I don't like.
You want to kind of define it for listeners who haven't encountered it? Because I don't know that there's molecular gastronomy in Rochester. Well, Charleston, South Carolina, there is. New York. Where's Linnea? New York City?
Chicago.
Oh, Chicago.
Yeah. Chicago's where all the cutting edge stuff happens.
Interesting.
And then what sticks to the wall, it goes to New York, and then it kind of goes out to the rest of the country from there. Molecular gastronomy is just kind of manipulating tastes and textures of food and presenting them in forms that they don't traditionally take. So you might take the chicken and put it in a blender and, you know, form it into a gelatinous cube and serve it on a spoon.
And
terrible example. But.
Yeah. Is that any more or less artistic when it comes to food for you?
For me, it is. I mean, for me, it's really pushing the boundaries
more artistic.
Of what is food and how can we do this differently? How can we, I mean, for me, the thing is creativity. How can we do something different? I mean, I hate repeating myself on menus. And I mean, in the same dish, I might plate two different ways in the same day just because I want to do it differently.
So when you talk about two disparate ideas on the same plate or part of the same dish, give me some examples.
Drew, I'd like to hand this off to you.
Is your brain stuck here? You've got a long menu here. I mean,
I have a long menu and a short memory.
Fritos and burgers.
Okay, so there's an example,
oh
and that's
boy.
Fritos on a burger.
I'm glad that you brought that up, Evan.
Fritos on a burger.
So that's another example. We were talking a little bit earlier about mass-produced food. Can that be art, right? Well, we've used it as a component in this thing, and some people don't get it. We put Fritos on the burger for salt and crunch. We think it's delicious. Most people that have had it, I think it's delicious and makes a really interesting, taste.
Cosine, yeah.
Yeah. But here it is. I mean, we're taking this mass-produced, probably not super artistic food item, Fritos, and kind of with the gestalt of it, making it something bigger.
So, yeah, one of the things we've kind of toyed around with the last year or so is cognitive dissonance in relation to food. And I can't remember exactly how this came up, but one night we were sort of sitting around and spitballing. And Sean wanted to know, like, could we make something that either looks completely disgusting, but tastes so wonderful that the consumers can get over that?
Well, intentionally looks disgusting?
Intentionally looks disgusting. Because yes, I think we've talked about it a little bit, where mm-hmm. you kind of eat with your eyes first.
Yes.
And so we kind of question, can we get around that and just eat with our mouths?
This is so interesting. Intention. This is a restaurant where people have to intentionally order something and give you money for it. And you want to make something that looks awful, but tastes great.
Well, not necessarily on our menu. We do a series of dinners, which
oh, they're trapped.
They're trapped.
Well,
maybe it's more like an exhibition, right? I mean, they come in, they pay a price of admission, and then they see 12 or 15 different
plates,
things,
items. Yeah.
Sometimes they're not plates.
We kind of divide things into what we do for the restaurant and then what we do for sort of special events, which is where we enact more of our creative tendencies.
So what did you end up creating that looks kind of funky but tastes great?
Look at that look.
I love this.
We made a Caesar salad sorbet one time that I'll let Drew talk a little bit about.
A what?
Sure. So that was for the, I think the, we did a wine dinner with Ravines from the Finger Lakes. Mm-hmm. And we like to always have a salad course at some point. But for this particular one, we decided that we didn't want it to be a traditional salad. We wanted it to taste like a traditional salad. So we made a Caesar salad sorbet that was served in sort of a Parmesan crisp cone. But we didn't tell anyone that. So on their menu that they had in front of them, it just said Caesar salad. So I remember when the course went out, everyone was kind of looking around the room, very confused. Like, we don't see a sorbet on this menu. Where's the salad? This is supposed to be salad. And just no one had any idea what was going on. So I think that's sort of that exploration of kind of dissonance, where we're challenging people's perceptions of what something has to be.
Which is what art is.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is totally art.
It took us 12 tries to get a sorbet that was tasted like a Caesar salad.
I've had some rough trials with your sorbets.
What was the response from the audience?
I'd say kind of 50-50. Half of them hated it.
There was a lot of kind of gasps and like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. Like, because I mean, it really tasted like a Caesar salad.
But I think that ties back into your experience at the Guggenheim. Yeah. Where, you know, someone thinks it's art, someone thinks it's just pretentious and stupid.
I don't think that. I think that's awesome. And actually, I will say this. Had I been dining with you that night and I encounter somebody, even if I didn't like the way it tasted, I would appreciate the effort. I would think that is really interesting because it does push people in different directions. I mean, but let me also ask you the why of it, because you've been asking a lot of the whys. We do something one way, why? Well, why do you want to push people on something like that? What's interesting about that to you?
I think for me personally, it's just, I want to experience as much of the world as I can, and I don't want that experience to be dictated by anyone. And that's something that Sean has definitely sort of impressed upon me. Because when we first started working together, I'd say, oh, you know, we have to pair this with this. And he'd say, well, why? And I'd say, well, that's just how it's done. And he would say, why? And I would say, I don't know. And so we'd kind of go from there and say, let's completely change that paradigm and explore creatively for us, because we don't want to be, we don't want that experience to be dictated to us. We want to create it for ourselves so we can experience the world in our own way.
Let me hit that point on something that comes to mind immediately, because why not continue the discussion on urinals? So it's the summer of food. Talked a lot about urinals this hour. And right over the urinal at Red Newt Bistro in the Finger Lakes for many years and probably still there today is a little cartoon, framed cartoon. And it's a man having dinner by sticking his fork into a piece of meat of some kind. And a woman is pouring wine into his glass. And he's saying, white wine? You mean this is fish?
Right.
That's what you mean.
Yes. That's what I mean.
That's what you mean. Can you drink red wine with fish?
Honestly, what I've discovered with Sean is that we can drink any wine with anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But to me, that came to mind because what you're saying is we're told that this is what you eat with this. This is what you drink with this. This is how you cook this. This is the spice you must use here. Well, maybe you want to do a what kind of cod?
Curry cod.
Or maybe you want to do a curry cod. Mm-hmm. Or you know, maybe you want to kick it out some different direction here. It's sort of a way of kind of asserting a little more freedom. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, life is what you make of it. And I think that's how we look at it and how we approach our pairing dinners for sure.
That's fun.
Yeah, my message is do what you want. Live your life how you want. You don't have to be bogged down by what people say it should be.
Absolutely.
And we try and spread that message through what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it goes sort of against human nature to an extent because, you know, we are meant to explore, and that's how we've colonized all of the continents or in outer space. Just we have sort of this inherent will to travel the unknown.
Well, listen, I know why I invited these four guests now. This has been a great discussion, and in a moment I'll get back to our listeners' feedbacks. In fact, one of our listeners wants to know what does happen when you boil pasta in a small pot of water.
So it actually comes out just as good. If you take your pound of pasta and you put cold water on the top of it in a frying pan and just bring it up to a boil, your pasta comes cooked just the same, and now you have this very starchy, rich water that you can use in your sauce if you want to.
Okay, so there you go. And look, you're getting applause through the glass there. and let me grab Joan and Hilton on the phone next. Go ahead, Joan.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
Very good.
Good. My question is, we're always looking for natural wines. One reason is because my dad, he's 99, he loves to drink wine, but they make him cough. So when we get a wine without sulfites or sulfates, I'm not sure which it is, he doesn't cough. So I'm not sure if we can find natural wine in New York State.
Joan, thank you. Drew?
Well, Rochester itself has actually had a bit of a natural wine resurgence in the last year. And again, natural wine is a whole nother podcast.
Natural wine's really vinegar. But what she means is probably wine without sulfites. Was that the term?
Low intervention wines.
Low intervention wines. That's a much better term for it, yeah.
To answer her question specifically, in Rochester alone, I mean, most of our wine is made minimalistly.
On our wine list, Drew?
On the wine list at Farmers Creek Side.
Yeah.
It's something I kind of specifically look for just because I find those wines to be a little bit more intriguing. But if you go to Pinnacle over on Monroe Avenue, Matt Yeager there carries a wide selection of natural wines. Marty's on Park Ave, I think their wine list is almost entirely natural as well. You can go to Avino, you can go to Swan Dive, you can go to Rue, and you're going to see natural wines there. So it's definitely something that's come into the market in a big way, especially in the last year or so. So it's definitely possible to find them around this area.
Joan, good luck to you there. So let me ask all of our guests now. Tell me something that you're really excited about creating that's either on a current menu or you've created recently or something that you've poured or paired or come up with recently that maybe falls under this category of experimentation or art of some kind. Lorna Underwood, I'll start with you. Lorna is the owner and general manager of Caribbean Heritage Restaurant. Go ahead, Lorna.
What I'm doing right now...
Get right on that mic for me.
Right now is my zucchini butternut medley. It's very colorful. It's done with some garlic and, you know, onion powder, and it's really tasty. So I think everybody should try that because it's very new to as far as it being a Caribbean restaurant, but it's one of my fusion pieces that people really enjoy. And another piece, we've decided to add some vegan options to it, and the curried lentils, I think everybody should try as well.
Very good. Kimberly Roth, owner and chef at Bamboo Panda Catering.
I'm actually currently trying to work on an entree dish for the Missing and Exploited Children's Dinner coming up that I am one of the guest chefs partaking in the event. Trying to do something with tuna. I've been experimenting with jerk tuna, doing it a tataki style with homemade jerk seasoning and marinating in soy for 24 hours and then pan searing it and then pairing it with a green tea soba noodle. So I'm trying to kind of fuse that together and, you know, hopefully my dish will win this year. I got beat last year by Joe from Nosh. I was a little upset at that, seeing I was working at his restaurant at the time. But hopefully this year, you know, my dish will win. But yeah, working on that. Yeah.
Okay. Sean Wolf from Farmers Creek Set.
What I'm currently most excited about is a dinner we have coming up on August 19th, a winemaker dinner featuring the wines of, what's it called, Drew?
Max Ferdinand Richter out of the Mosel, Germany.
Oh, Richter. So good.
So it's all that Rieslings with varying levels of sweetness and acidity. And we haven't planned the menu. We're kind of in the research phase right now. And that's the most exciting time for me is saying, okay, we're going to do all Rieslings. How are we going to do red meat with this? How are we going to do some bigger foods with this? And that's always exciting. And we have a lot of fails along the way. And that's exciting, too, is seeing like, okay, this didn't work. Let's go in a new direction.
We're going to get back to the subject of fails in just a second, but I'm going to ask Drew Chappett, who is the sommelier at Farmers Creekside, to weigh in. Do you agree with that? Is that something you're focused on right now, that is sort of an artistic idea there?
Yeah, we have a big month coming up. We're doing a charity dinner on the 11th at the Smith Opera House in Geneva. So we have to start thinking about that as well. And the week after the Richter dinner, we have Midtown Eats. So we have our work cut out for us, but definitely the pairing dinners, especially the wine pairing dinners, obviously, for me, are what I really focus on. So
I love that idea. And I love the idea of sort of, at least for me, some of the richer Rieslings with cuts of meat and some of the things you can do there.
Yeah, I've been threatening Sean with an all-Riesling dinner for over 2 years now, so I'm excited that I finally have the chance to do that.
Good luck to you. Now, on the subject of a lot of fails, right? I think to the cocktail makers in the world, there's a lot of really interesting, creative people in the Rochester scene, et cetera. And I got home recently from a long trip away, and I was going to make a cocktail, and I thought I had the ingredients, and I did not. So I'm like, well, I'm going to play around with a few things here. And made one pass at something, and it was really bad. It was really bad. But I'm like, I feel like there's a platform to work with here. So I made another pass at it. It was really bad, but less bad. And then a third pass, I'm like, oh, man, I stuck the landing here. This is good. And by the way, listeners, if you want to make it, pour one out in honor of me. I call it the Ridgeville in honor of my mother in North Ridgeville, Ohio, because I got back from visiting her that day. And it's an ounce of rum, and it's an ounce of fresh squeezed lime juice, 3/4 of an ounce of homemade simple syrup, and then 1/4 of an ounce of green chartreuse, and 1/8 of an ounce of St. Elizabeth's Allspice Dram, which, Lorna, is right up your alley. So, you know, it's kind of just like a funky summer daiquiri kind of in that family. And it took several passes. So can it be art if there's failure multiple times?
I think that's what makes it art.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think that honing in, feeling and seeing the thing in your mind and then trying to get to it through trial and error, I think that's a big part of what makes it art.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the most historic artists, I mean, Van Gogh, if you look at his notebooks, he does sketch after sketch after sketch before you get to the final painting. So,
you mean there's like a Mona Laurie out there, and then there's like a Jane Lisa, and then the Mona Lisa was the good one. There can be multiple passes.
Everything's a process until you run out of time, or you, in our case, or you finally reach something that you're satisfied with. But that never really seems to happen on our end, because we always think there's room for improvement, and everything can always be made better, and everything can constantly evolve. So we're basically still working on the menu until the course is, you know, 2 minutes from hitting the table. So.
Literally 2 minutes
always.
Before it hits the table.
Same with you? Yeah?
Always.
And how do you feel about multiple passes at different recipes, Lorna? I guess
you gotta have
trial and error.
A Caribbean rum cake that I make. And I now know that I have it, but it's been trial and error, trial and error. And it's a recipe I got from when I was like 10, I went somewhere with my aunt who was, it was Christmas time, And we have that rum cake at Christmas time, but now it's become all year round. And just watching them make it, they didn't have recipes. Nothing is recipe. So we just went along and made it, but it came out perfectly then. And ever since then, I've been trying to get it.
I've been chasing it,
and I finally got it where I'm able to say, this is it.
20 seconds. Is there something for you that stands out as trial and error?
I mean, sous vide. Just trying to sous vide. I've been trying to experiment with like pork belly and stuff right now for my steam buns and doing it 18 hours. Am I doing it 17 hours? My temperatures. I mean, that's something I've been actually playing around with. It's really out of my realm and my wheelhouse for what I do. So, yeah, sous vide.
Well, one of the really cool things is when your mind changes, and all four of our guests have pushed me to think about food as art in different ways, art as different in different ways, failure in different ways. Wonderful conversation. Kimberly Roth, owner and chef at Bamboo Panda Catering, good luck to you.
Thanks
for being here.
You.
You'll find Lorna Underwood at Caribbean Heritage Restaurant. Where?
719 South Plymouth Avenue.
Sean Wolf and Drew Shepard, you're going to find out at Farmers Creekside Tavern and Inn at the beautiful, like ridiculously beautiful Owatka Creek in Rochester. If you've never been there, you're going to email me after you go there and be like, oh my gosh, this place is amazing. Where is it?
1 Main Street, Leroy, New York.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Adam.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers to all of you. Our thanks to Megan Mac producer Rob, Frank volunteering today. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow.